at amos.indiana.edu. To get podcasts, click on the podcast button. I'm Yael Cassander.
And I'm Don Glass.
In sports, Kerry Wood once struck out 20 batters. Now he'll finish off opponents. As expected, the Chicago Cubs made Wood their closer today, and Jason Marquis got the nod as the fifth starter. The oft-injured Wood was converted to a reliever last season to preserve his troublesome right arm and shoulder. He entered spring training in a three-way competition for closer after the Cubs moved Ryan Dempster to the rotation. Tiger Woods has failed to win a golf tournament. It doesn't happen often, but today in Doral, Florida, Woods finished two shots back of CA Championship winner Jeff Ogilvie. The Australian finished 17 under par, while Ratif Goosen, Jim Furyk, and Vijay Singh were all one back. The University of Illinois women's basketball team squares off against Drake tonight in the Women's National Invitation Tournament. The Illini, with a record of 19-14, enter Assembly Hall tonight on a roll, having won four of their last five, with a lone loss coming at the buzzer to Purdue in the Big Ten tournament. Drake, at 22-10, finished the season in a third-place tie with Illinois State and Evansville in the Missouri Valley Conference. Tip-off tonight at the Hall, 7 o'clock. In men's action, last week Illinois State won its first postseason game in 10 years by beating Utah State 61-57. Tonight the Redbirds move into the second round of the men's NIT, where they'll take on Dayton. The Flyers advanced with a 66-57 victory over Cleveland State. And Bradley takes on Ohio tonight in a college basketball invitational tournament matchup at Carver Arena. The Braves will try to get off to a better start than they did in their last game when they trailed Cincinnati 10-2 before pulling out a win. That's sports.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Black Law Students Association and the Federalist Society, presenting Drs. Michael Eric Dyson of Georgetown University and William B. Allen of Michigan State University, debating affirmative action, worthwhile or a flawed policy, on Tuesday, March 25th at 6:30 p.m. in Lincoln Hall. More information at web.mac.com/affirmativeaction.
It's 2:42, 41 degrees in Urbana as the sun is out. Medical records are usually a personal matter, but if you're running for president, your health is now considered important for the public to know. During his first run for the White House in 2000, John McCain released details about his bout with melanoma. This time, as the presumptive Republican nominee, he's promised to release his full health records soon. But historically, candidates have evaded questions about their health. Sometimes they have even lied. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
Back in 1992, former Senator Paul Tsongas was campaigning for the Democratic presidential nomination. That case of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma he had in the 1980s? He said the potentially deadly cancer was not a factor.
I went through the bone marrow transplant over 5 years ago, and 5 years is the standard definition of cure. But the fact is, I've been out there for almost 9 months, much longer than anybody else, and it has not affected my capacity to campaign.
His doctors, even under direct questioning, denied the lymphoma had returned until after Tsongas had dropped out of the race. Tsongas was dead within 3 years. Political scientist Rose McDermott points out that it was the vice president spot that would have been the really important one on the ticket.
He started chemotherapy the day that he would have been inaugurated had he been elected, and he would have died in office.
The lack of disclosure of Tsongas' health problems wasn't at all unusual, says presidential historian Robert Dalek.
The candidates are very leery about letting on to any weakness, any flaws, because they're so afraid that it will bring them down.
He's got a long list of historical examples.
Woodrow Wilson. When he runs in 1912, he had already had a series of small strokes.
Wilson made it through his first term okay, but towards the end of his second term, he had a stroke that left him totally disabled. His wife essentially ran the White House for 18 months. Franklin Roosevelt famously hid the fact that his legs were paralyzed after a bout with polio. Rose McDermott says even though a lot of people had polio back then, Roosevelt asked his friends and advisors to help him keep it secret.
He thought he couldn't get elected if people thought he couldn't walk. I mean, he was very, very clear that the nation didn't want a crippled president while they felt crippled by the economy.
He didn't allow himself to be photographed in his wheelchair. he walked, by leaning on his aides or his sons. The candidate with perhaps the thickest medical chart was John Kennedy, says Robert Dalek.
He had Addison's disease. He had terrible back problems for which he had to be on constant painkillers because it was so miserable. He had terrible allergies for which he took all sorts of antihistamines.
He had an inflammation of his prostate that led to periodic fevers and infections.
In the 1950s, he was hospitalized 9 times, once for 19 days, a couple of times for 7 days, the other times for 3 days at a time. It was never revealed to the public.
During the Democratic Convention in 1960, opponent Lyndon Johnson raised questions about Kennedy's Addison's disease, a hormonal condition that doctors were only just learning to control. Kennedy's people brought out a physician who said the problems were over with, when in fact Kennedy had to add steroids to his long list of daily medications. What happened to Thomas Eagleton 12 years after Kennedy's campaign for the presidency shows how sensitive the public can be to a candidate's health issues. Democrat George McGovern picked Eagleton for his vice presidential running mate. Word got out that Eagleton had been treated for depression with electroshock therapy, and Eagleton made an announcement.
On 3 occasions in my life, I have voluntarily gone into hospitals as a result of nervous exhaustion and fatigue.
2.5 weeks after he was nominated, Eagleton withdrew from the race, saying he didn't want to hurt the Democratic Party. While health information might knock someone off a ticket or lose an election, health problems, even serious ones, don't necessarily ruin a presidency. Most medical experts agree that Abraham Lincoln, for example, had depression. And Rose McDermott said while Roosevelt's polio may have been a tragedy for him, it was good for the public.
Prior to coming down with polio, you'll see reports of people calling him condescending or patronizing or, you know, snooty. And you see these descriptions of him that are quite at variance with the person he became as president.
Roosevelt's wife Eleanor said his struggles with polio were what made him so sensitive to the problems of poverty. As a result of all this, there have been occasional calls for presidential candidates to be evaluated by independent physicians, with the results to be released to the public. Those calls have gone nowhere. Joanne Silberner, NPR News, Washington.
It's 2:48. Around 40,000 tourists are expected to visit Antarctica this year. They are going for various reasons, not least to see the continent before the changing climate changes it too much. NPR's Gwen Tompkins reports.
There comes a time when the ties of home life loosen. Some give way completely, and one is moved, as if by nature herself, to put to sea. At least, that's what the books tell us. Herman Melville called that feeling when it is November in my soul. A sea journey puts you on a continuum of discovery that began well before Magellan, or Columbus, or red-faced old Leif Erikson. You are connected somehow to the age of exploration, even when your boat has Wi-Fi and an all-you-can-eat buffet.
Let's see. We're at 54 degrees south, 68 degrees west, and we're standing 71 feet above the water. Right now we're doing 3 miles an hour.
Michael Callwhite is standing on the deck of the MS Fram, an ice-breaking Norwegian pleasure ship that has just pulled away from the southernmost tip of South America. The Fram is heading south, and Callwhite's fancy GPS watch is tracking the ship's progress. Antarctica, you see, is the dream, the destination, the prize. And Callwhite, who ordinarily brokers leveraged buyouts in Chicago, can feel that he's at the beginning of something extraordinary.
Surprisingly, you find the occasional person who's actually been here before, and they get really excited and they tell you about how wonderful this trip is. It's almost a religious experience to go down there. I'm like, how can that be?
There are more than 200 passengers aboard the ship and about 1.5 million reasons why they're here. Lorraine Longmore keeps a bed and breakfast in Connecticut, and she says she feels like one of the great explorers. Not Ernest Shackleton, per se, or Robert Falcon Scott, or even the Norwegian Roald Amundsen. No, Longmore says she feels like her mother.
My mother was a world traveler and did it on freighters around the world twice and several other voyages. I have never had that opportunity, so I'm so excited about this one.
But somewhere amid all the optimism is the wisp of a worry. that Antarctica could no longer be the same continent that the polar explorers encountered. After all, climates everywhere are changing. The scientists say so, Al Gore says so, and the company says so too.
We always point out that it melts around the outside. So most of the changes that you see for snow and ice melting is around the edges of the continent.
That's Bob Rowland, a geologist who's been hired by the Hurtigruten Cruise Line to talk about the effects of global warming on the Antarctic Peninsula. He can't say for sure that what we'll see is the climate changing before our very eyes, but apparently some parts of Antarctica are not as cold as they used to be.
If you look at some of the maps that have been produced by the National Science Foundation and the British Antarctic Survey, on those maps you can see changes that have taken place since the 60s.
On the Fram's main deck, it's plenty cold. 10 minutes into the cruise, we're already wearing fleece jackets and hats, and the wind is picking up, up, up. Technically, it's evening, but it's also summer at the bottom of the world, and the sun, like a fussy child, is refusing to go to bed. Through the windows of the dining hall below, we can see the ship gaining on the waves. The Fram will soon enter the Drake Passage, where the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans meet. These are some of the most treacherous waters on the planet.
First, take your shoes off. Insert the legs.
Rule number one of travel is to live to tell the tale. So here we are, shivering in the wind that first night. We're learning how to climb into the most unattractive, but life-saving, polar suits. If the ship sinks, we'll be the ones wearing orange.
It's just a very inhospitable and unpredictable and potentially dangerous environment we are sailing into.
That's expedition leader Karen Strand, a Norwegian who resembles the young Doris Day. In Norwegian, the word Fram means forward, and in English, Karen Strand means business. She dresses down anyone who won't bundle up.
So be prepared for severe and changeable weather. This is not home.
A boat like ours sank last year, and everyone aboard survived. But it reminds us that this part of the world is filled with stories of heroic failures and tragic loss. Herman Gran is a kind-faced Norwegian who's here to tell tales of adventure and danger in the Antarctic.
My father was Trygve Gran. He was a skiing expert on the British Antarctic expedition from 1910 to 1913.
It was during that legendary Antarctic expedition that the first explorer made it all the way to the South Pole. Unfortunately for the British, and for Sir Robert Falcon Scott in particular, the Norwegians beat them by a nose. Scott and his mates died on the walk back to camp, and Herman's father found their disappointed remains. Herman has his father's diary entry, dated November 12, 1913.
We buried our dead companions this morning. It was a truly solemn moment. Driving snow whirled up around us, and by the end of the hymns, the white mantle had covered the dead.
Above the graves, the men fashioned a cross out of a pair of skis. Herman's father wore Sir Robert Scott's pair back, so that some small part of this great explorer could complete the journey home. But it's another world entirely on the seventh floor lounge deck, where the view is wet and the martinis are dry. Ocean liners have cornered the market on comfortable travel to Antarctica. Ours has a full bar, pistachio ice cream, and the incomparable Billie Holiday. And what do you know? After almost 40 hours of us sipping and pitching and sailing 600 miles south, one lone iceberg interrupts the limitless horizon. Then two, then 20, and 30. And sooner than you can say, land ho! All the ship's windows fill with the most unusual skyline. Endless mountains and glaciers are frozen under elaborate petticoats of ice and snow. Today, we're dropping anchor for the first time off the coast of the Shetland Islands, that much closer to the Antarctic Peninsula. Down in the mudroom, the air is positively electric. Fathers and sons, lifelong bridge partners, doctors' wives, and doctors' husbands are struggling gamely into their Wellingtons and queuing for the motorboats. They want to see something that eludes the rest of us. They want to be somewhere that gives them goosebumps. They want to touch someplace that leaves them cold. Gwen Tompkins, NPR News.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Provena Covenant Medical Center in Urbana, rated a top 5% hospital by Health Grades. More information available at provena.org. The staff and physicians of Provena encourage you to join them in supporting WILL.
This is Stacia J. Pierce. During our Spring Power Hour on April 3rd, we'll challenge listeners to match, in 1 hour, the entire amount of money in our member match fund that we raise between now and then. Please contribute today. Mail your check or give online at willpledge.org.
It's 2:56. Coming up at 3 today, The World from PRI. On the program today, baseball has a huge following in parts of Asia and Latin America. Some baseball promoters believe Africa could be next as a market for fans and a source for new major league talent. But first, Africa's children have to learn how to play the game. Pitching baseball to Africa, that in the day's news coming up this afternoon on The World. Tomorrow in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine, we'll get a guided tour of the human brain. Our guide will be a neuroscientist. His name is Sam Wang, and he is co-author of Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys But Never Forget How to Drive, and Other Puzzles of Everyday Life. I'll invite your telephone calls for Sam Wang tomorrow following the 1 o'clock news.
Earth and Sky.
In 2004, the Indian Ocean tsunami claimed the lives of tens of thousands of people who didn't have time to evacuate to higher ground.
Tony Song and his colleagues at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, are developing a new warning system they say would quickly alert coastal dwellers that a tsunami might be coming. It uses GPS technology to detect the horizontal motion of the sea floor.
These scientists say they can use this technology to predict a tsunami before a tsunami even starts. This is a new way of looking at how an earthquake causes a tsunami, says Tony Song.
Until now, scientists have tried to predict tsunamis by measuring the magnitude of an earthquake. The more powerfully the earthquake pushes the ocean floor up, the larger the potential tsunami, or so researchers thought.
Song and his team have found that what really matters is not the vertical movement of the ocean floor. Instead, the size and power of a tsunami depends on the amount of energy an earthquake transfers to the ocean when it causes the ocean floor to move from side to side.
GPS technology can detect this side-to-side movement of the ocean floor and almost instantly calculate the type of tsunami it will generate. Our thanks today to NASA. Explore, discover, understand. We're Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
It's 2 minutes before 3 o'clock. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft is our technical director today, the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Mike Solo's forecast for Illinois and Indiana tonight, north, in the north, and in central Indiana. Mostly cloudy with a chance for showers, possibly mixed with snow in northern Indiana. In central Illinois tonight, partly to mostly cloudy. And in the south, clear to partly cloudy. Lows ranging from 28 in eastern Indiana to 40 in western Illinois. Tomorrow in northern Illinois, a chance for a few showers early, then partly sunny. Elsewhere, mostly cloudy with widely scattered showers possible. Highs tomorrow ranging from 47 in northern Indiana to 62 in southwestern Illinois. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, partly to mostly cloudy, breezy, not as cold tonight, the low 33, the wind from the south at 15 to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, windy, and mild. Occasional drizzle or a few showers possible during the afternoon. The high 56, the wind from the south at 20 to 25 miles per hour tomorrow. Tomorrow night, considerable cloudiness, the low 35. Wednesday, partly sunny, the high 54. Wednesday night, mostly cloudy with a chance for showers, the low 35. Thursday, the outlook, cloudy with showers and thunderstorms, likely the high around 50. You're tuned to the Information Advantage, WILL, Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Coming up next, it's The World from PRI. That's up next here on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Don't go away. ¶¶